Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Amy Goodman is a journalist, executive producer of the news program Democracy Now!, and a leading advocate of independent news media. Some, including I, have criticized her for dodging certain issues, 9/11 chief among them. Overall, though, I think Amy Goodman has done enormous good service in reporting facts and perspectives about current events, facts and perspectives that the power elite and the corporate media are trying their hardest to suppress. She spoke in Syracuse, New York on November 3rd. This long speech covered many topics, not all for the first time. For me, the best parts of the talk came in the second half, and those we shall hear now. Hard as it may be to believe, upstate New York State, including Syracuse and nearby Rochester, was once a hotbed of radical activism. The abolitionist movement and the suffragist movement were roaring there. Some great figures of each movement were associated with the area, and in fact are buried in the same cemetery in Rochester, Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony. But political change is made not by great leaders, but by popular movements. It was the suffragist movement, not Susan B. Anthony, that extended the vote to women. Goodman tells the story of other movements, too. For instance, Rosa Parks was not a random lone individual when she broke the color line on the Montgomery Municipal Bus System in 1955. She was a well-trained, well-prepared member of an organized popular movement to integrate Montgomery City Services. Goodman also tells the story of the athletes at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, who famously gave a Black Power salute on the winner's podium. And she tells of Occupy Wall Street and Tahrir Square. In solidarity, there is strength, and in popular movements, there is power. Not in charismatic leaders, but in thousands taking to the streets, if needed, to press their demands. That's what forces politicians to act. There's a summary of what Amy Goodman said, but let's hear the details from her. She's a very good storyteller, and her stories are well worth hearing. Here's Amy Goodman.
But coming here to Syracuse, to this historic area, learning about what took place in 1851, for example, the Jerry Rescue, and there's a monument downtown I hope to see before we leave, this hotbed of abolitionist activism. People saying no to the Fugitive Slave Act, that they would free those who were enslaved who came to Syracuse. It makes me think about the importance of movements. And it makes me think about what's happening in this country today. You know, on Election Day 2008, I think the whole world heaved a sigh of relief when Barack Obama was elected president. Republican, Democrat, American, non-American, for so long, people had hit their heads against a brick wall. They felt perhaps that wall had become a door, and the door had opened a crack, and the question was, would it be kicked open or slammed shut? And that's up to more than one person, because after all, the community organizer-in-chief became the commander-in-chief. And what does that mean for movements? It's a very profound question. I mean, the fact that Barack Obama was a community organizer, and just think parents all over this country are saying to their kids, maybe you could be a community organizer too. That's a very good thing. But what does it mean when he becomes commander-in-chief? People who did vote for him, the masses, the millions of young people who turned out, the people who were disenfranchised before, who never bothered to vote, who turned out, suddenly they saw this right-wing backlash. They didn't want to contribute to it, but they also saw that the person who they had such high hopes in. I mean, I think the anti-war movement helped to elect Barack Obama. What was the only difference almost between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? Barack Obama had been against the Iraq War, and Hillary Clinton had voted to authorize it as senator and hung on to her rationale until, well, almost the bitter end, when she realized she was losing on this point and finally said maybe it was a mistake. And yet the anti-war movement that helped to elect Barack Obama then went on to see that the war in Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history, had become Obama's war, had become Obama's surge. The drone attacks that people are just down the road right now on trial for at the Hancock base, that these were intensifying under President Obama, the man they had elected, perhaps you had elected. That the person who one of the first acts in office had announced Guantanamo would be closed, within a year it hasn't been closed. That the man who talked about the importance of immigration reform, and now more immigrants have been deported under the Obama administration than under any president in history. Certainly well more than President Bush ever dared to have deported. When I say ever dared, because he knew the backlash that he would face from people who then went on to elect President Obama. And now what do they do when this president, who they elected, don't carry out their wishes? Well, there is a force more powerful than the most powerful person on earth. And that force is all of you, is people, is movements. It always has, it always will be. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. Frederick Douglass, the power of these movements and where we stand today. You know, when President Obama sits in the Oval Office and those who are used to having the ear of the most powerful person on earth whisper in his ear and make their demands, if he can't point out the window of the Oval Office and say, if we do that, they will storm the Bastille. If there's no one out there, he's in big trouble. Sometimes he may need people to be out there to push forward on a plan he supports, and many other times he may not agree with you at all, but that does not determine movements. What determines movements is what you see the reality on the ground and what you want to do about it. And I think that's why we're seeing these Occupy encampments all over the country and all over the world. But when the Obamas, when Senator Obama was elected president before he was inaugurated, I was invited on CNN the day that the Obamas went into the White House, remember when they were meeting the Bushes for the first time, to talk about the significance of this moment. So I was in the studio and the hosts were chattering about something, and I'm watching the Obamas walk into the White House on the video screen, and they asked me about something else. I said, no, we have to take pause. This is an historic moment. Barack Hussein Obama and Michelle LeVon Robinson Obama. She is the descendant of slaves, so their daughters, Sasha and Malia, are the descendants of slaves. They are walking into the White House, the most famous house on earth, where they will soon reside, which was built by slaves. This is an historic moment. We must take pause. And I thought about a house not so far from the White House, a couple of hours away on the eastern shore of Maryland. This is the story of Frederick Douglass. He was born on the eastern shore of Maryland, and he was enslaved as a youth and a teenager. It might not surprise you to know he was a troublesome slave. So he was handed over to a slave breaker, a man named Ed Covey. His property was called Mount Misery, and that's where Frederick Douglass was brought, where he was tortured, where he was beaten, and Frederick Douglass fought back, and he headed north, and he changed the world. That property today, Mount Misery, is owned by Donald Rumsfeld. He bought it in 2003 to be his vacation home. It's in St. Michael's, Maryland. And when I heard that story, I was surprised, and I did a lot of internet research. Could this be true? And I thought, well, you know, as a journalist, I really have to investigate this. I have to see this with my own eyes. And so my colleague Dennis Moynihan and I headed down to St. Michael's, Maryland. And I realized when we got there, I had no idea where Donald Rumsfeld lived. But in New York, I go to this coffee shop in Lower Manhattan, this wonderful old brick building, and there's a plaque outside that says, "This was the printing press of David Ruggles, born a free black man in Connecticut. And when Frederick Douglass came north, he took refuge here." You know, Frederick Douglass started the North Star newspaper. David Ruggles had this printing press. These men saw media as their form of liberation, because information is power. And so being down in St. Michael's, I see this coffee shop ahead of me trying to figure out, where am I going to find Donald Rumsfeld's house? And I think, oh, a coffee shop. You see a theme in my life. And it was an organic coffee shop, so I thought, they'll tell the truth. So I went inside, and they said, "What would you like?" I said, "I'd like to know where Donald Rumsfeld lives." And they said, "Oh, you just go out back, you drive down the road. You'll hit Mount Pleasant Road. Don't go down that road. You make a right and another right, and then you go to the end of the road. That's Mount Misery Road, and Donald Rumsfeld lives at the end of it." So we drove down the road. We didn't go down Mount Pleasant Road. We made a right and another right. It seems we couldn't go right enough. And we went down that road, and there we saw the black SUV with the black tinted windows of the Secret Service, and we knew we had arrived. So I got out quickly, and I took out my video camera, and I was zooming in as they were zooming out. And I'm thinking, does Donald Rumsfeld understand the significance of this historic place? But sure enough, as I'm zooming in with my video camera, I see a stake in the ground right next to the driveway that says Mount Misery. We head off to this ancient black church down the road. It was Sunday morning down an old dirt road. And I went into the sanctuary, and the older folks were having Sunday school there. And I asked a woman, I said, "I have to ask, what do you think of this historic place where you live? I mean, you have Mount Misery where Frederick Douglass was tortured and beaten, and now Mount Misery is owned by Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, who's known for torture. What do you make of this?" And she said, "I can't comment right now. We're in church." Well, from Mount Misery to Mount Hope. I was recently speaking in Geneva, New York, and a young woman came up to me at the end of the talk, and she said, "Would you come with me to Mount Hope Cemetery in Rochester, right, not far from here?" She said, "I want to show you the tombstone of Frederick Douglass." And I had to leave the next morning. It was a snowstorm, 5 a.m, heading off to Denver. And I said, "I really should, please. It's okay if you'll meet me before 5 at the cemetery." So we went to Mount Hope, and she was standing under the snowflakes. And we went to the tombstone and brushed off the snow. And there was the grave of Frederick Douglass. And then she had a twinkle in her eye, and she said, "Please come with me across the cemetery. I want to show you one more grave." I said, "Oh my God, I'm going to miss it. Please," she said. So we ran across the cemetery, and there was a smaller grave with a smaller tombstone, a smaller marker of Susan B. Anthony, who's buried next to her sister. And when I told the story at Wesleyan College, a woman came up to me and said, "Did you go to Susan B. Anthony's house? Because right near it is a statue, not of a general, but of Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass having tea together." See, Susan B. Anthony, the great suffragist, the great feminist, the great women's rights activist, was not just a feminist and suffragist and great women's rights activist, but an abolitionist as well. And Frederick Douglass, the greatest abolitionist of all time, was also a great supporter of women's rights. It was he who seconded the resolution at the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention of 1848 for women to have the right to vote before many women supported this. The women's rights movement, the abolition movement, the civil rights movement, these are the movements that have made this country great. And so I raced off to the airport and missed my plane. So I called up Dennis and said, "I got to get to Denver. They're going to kill me." And he brings up the blueprints of the Rochester airport on his computer. He says, "Are you in the Susan B. Anthony terminal or the Frederick Douglass terminal?" I said, "Oh, please, this is no time for jokes. I've got to get on the next plane." He said, "I'm not kidding." And all of a sudden I saw, as I'm standing helpless in this airport, there it was. There were the words, Frederick Douglass. I hadn't even seen them. And in the other wing, Susan B. Anthony. Every once in a while you have to stop and smell the coffee. But these movements, how important they are. They are what determine history. Rosa Parks, why it's relevant to talk about Rosa Parks today with the Occupy movement. You know how brave she was when she did what she did December 1st, 1955, right? Sat on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, refuses to get up for a white passenger, and she launches the modern day civil rights movement 4 days later, December 5th. She's in court. The Montgomery Improvement Association has its movement to elect its leader to lead the bus boycott that'll lead to the desegregation of transportation in the South, and they choose as their leader a young minister who had just come into town, Dr. Martin Luther King, and Rosa Parks helped to launch Martin Luther King. When she died a few years ago, Democracy Now! Raced down to Washington. She was the first African-American woman to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda, then brought to a Washington church before the big funeral in Detroit. Thousands came out just for the memorial service. Oprah was inside. Cicely Tyson was inside. Hundreds of people were outside, big loudspeakers. We were outside where it's often more interesting to be. And I interviewed a young woman student. I said, why are you here? And she said, oh, I emailed my professors this morning. I said, I won't be in class today. I'm going to get an education. And if there are any students here, you cannot quote me on that. But I do look forward to seeing you tomorrow at Syracuse University, because we're going to be talking to students about 10:30. Rosa Parks. When the media covered Rosa Parks' death and her life, they got it wrong. Oh, they said she was a great civil rights leader, and that was true. But they said she was a tired seamstress when she sat down on the bus. They said she was no troublemaker. That's where they got it wrong. Rosa Parks was a first-class troublemaker. Rosa Parks knew exactly what she was doing when she sat down on the bus. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked under E.D. Nixon, who came out of radical labor politics, who was the president of the NAACP. They've been challenging the racist laws of the South for years. Rosa trained at the Highlander Center, where Dr. King had been as well, black and white together, working to change the race laws in the South, to most effectively strategize to do this. She had sat down on the bus many times before and refused to get up, as did other young women. But this was the magic moment. And you never know when that magic moment will come. I mean, think about the Occupy movement. Do you know the number of older union leaders who are scratching their heads? I went to the mass union rally a few weeks ago, where all the union presidents in New York spoke at Foley Square. One of them had been in Tunisia and had gotten calls, said, you're not going to believe this Occupy movement. They had held a rally in Washington last year, 100,000 strong. They hardly got any coverage. And they're saying, what is this movement that is ripping like wildfire through this country, whose principles they too believed in? And they said they didn't want to co-opt the movement, but they definitely wanted to support it. You never know when that moment will come. But when you're involved in social change, you help to determine history. You lay the foundation. You do determine the future. And I think that is what we are seeing today. And the number of people I've seen down at Occupy Wall Street who've come to visit. Just the other day, John Carlos. Do you remember John Carlos, 1968? There it is, the Black Power Fist, the most famous, iconic sports moment in sports history. Mexico City, the Olympics, John Carlos got the bronze medal in the 200-meter dash. Tommy Smith got the... He won. He got the gold. They actually were part of an Olympic committee for human rights. They had been talking with Dr. Martin Luther King. This was 1968, about boycotting the Olympics. But then John Carlos, so we just had him on Democracy Now!, and I hope everyone reads the John Carlos story. He wrote it with a great sports writer, Dave Zirin. It's just out, and it's a wonderful account of his life. Again, you never know when this moment will come. They were going to boycott, and Dr. King was supporting them. Dr. King was assassinated, you may remember, April 4th, 1968. The Olympics were that summer. Not 2 weeks before the Olympics began in Mexico City was the Tlatelolco Massacre, or Autonomous University in Mexico City. We don't still know how many, was it hundreds of students were killed, but John Carlos knew when he flew into Mexico City, and Tommy Smith knew too, about what was happening in the United States and what was happening in Mexico. They decided they would run, but they would use their moment in the sun to change the world, and that's what they did. So with the gold medal and with the bronze medal, well, they were about to get it. They walked out onto the medal stand after they won their race. With Peter Norman there, he took second. He was white. He was an Australian. And you remember that moment with John Carlos and Tommy Smith when they put up their hands, each one with a black glove and a black power salute as the Star Spangled Banner played. You might wonder why one had a right glove and one had a left glove, because they actually had not exactly planned to do this. And they only had one pair of gloves. In fact, Peter Norman, who was the white second place runner, he wanted to wear a glove too in support of them, but they didn't have a third one. And so he settled for the button, and he paid the price for this when he came home to Australia, as did John Carlos and Tommy Smith, the difficulty they had in getting jobs, the difficulty they had in their families, the death threats, but they did what they did, and they didn't just put up their hands in the power salute. They wore, John Carlos wore beads to protest lynching, and they both rolled up their pants, and they took off their shoes on the medal stand. They were wearing black socks to protest the poverty of black children in the United States, and John Carlos had zipped up his jacket, which you weren't supposed to do over an Olympic jersey, but he wanted to identify with the working men and women of the United States. And that is that image that so many people know today. And John Carlos told an amazing story, and a few nights ago I had dinner with Robert King Wilkerson. You might know who he was, in solitary confinement for 39 years at Angola Prison in Louisiana. I just saw him in New York. He was one of those who carved the monument to John Carlos and Tommy Smith at San Jose State. But this is the story John Carlos told. They wanted to make this big monument for them at San Jose State. And he went there and they showed him the model and they were starting to carve the stone. And he said, no, I won't be any part of this. And the president of the university said, what are you talking about? We're moving forward on this. This is such a big deal. They commissioned a great artist. And he said, where's Peter Norman? I said, no, this is you and Tommy. He said, no, only if all three of us are there, because Peter Norman was a critical part of what we did that day. And they said, he doesn't want to be a part of it. He said, I don't believe you. And he went into the president's office. They said, okay, call him. We got to build this monument. And he called him. He said, Peter, what's going on? Why aren't you on this medal stand that's being remembered for all time? He said, no, this is your moment. He said, but you can do something for me. And he said, what's that? He said, leave a space where I stood, and you could have a plaque right there, if you want, that says my name. But make sure you leave a space so that everyone who comes to see this monument can stand in my place, and they can take pictures. And so that's what the monument is today. For John Carlos and Tommy Smith, Peter Norman has since died, and it represents not only the three of them, in that moment, looking ahead, but everyone who comes to honor them. John Carlos was honoring the young people at Occupy Wall Street, saying, you are carrying on the torch. And Jesse Jackson went there the other night, and he joined arms with young people at the first aid tent because he thought the police were moving in. Jesse Jackson, who was there on April 4th, 1968, when Dr. King was assassinated, you know, at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. This past few weeks, the monument to Dr. King was dedicated in Washington, and President Obama dedicated that monument. Just down the road, in front of the Supreme Court, Cornel West was getting arrested. And Cornel West said, as he was getting arrested with a number of other people protesting the level of corruption that money, the level protesting what money has done to politics in this country, swamping politics, drowning democracy, said if the monument to Dr. King is being dedicated today, I think there's no place that Dr. King would rather be than with me on the steps of Supreme Court getting arrested. He said someone has got to get arrested today. These movements and these moments, when President Obama was running for president, he was in the backyard of a Montclair, New Jersey house speaking to about 100 people. It wasn't clear he would be elected at that time. And at the end of an evening, someone raised their hand just as he was leaving, and he asked Senator Obama, "What will you do about the Middle East?" And President Obama, Senator Obama, told the story of A. Philip Randolph, you know, the greatest organizer of the 20th century, organized the 1963 March on Washington, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. A. Philip Randolph met with FDR, was brought there by Eleanor Roosevelt, and told FDR about the condition of black people in this country and working people in this country. And the story goes, and Senator Obama told the story to the group, that FDR listened intently, and when A. Philip Randolph was done, he said, "I don't disagree with anything you've said, but you have to make me do it." That's what Obama said to the person who asked about policy in the Middle East. He said, "Make me do it." That is the challenge today. That's how democracy operates. And first and foremost, we need a media that provides a forum to speak to, for people to speak to each other. And I just want to end with this story, this image. The last week of the Egyptian Revolution, right before Mubarak fell, we heard that a young man named Karim Amer, a young blogger who'd been imprisoned under Mubarak for 4 years, had disappeared from Tahrir. We started to look for his blog, look for any evidence of where he was. It ended up he had been put in a desert jail. But when we found his blog, it said across the top, "This is dedicated to Hans and Sophie Scholl." I don't know how many of you know who Hans and Sophie Scholl are, but they were that brother and sister in World War II who formed with their professor and other students and workers the White Rose Collective. They were not Jewish. They were German Christians. They thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? They thought the best they could do was get out information so that the Germans would never be able to say, "We didn't know." And so they published a series of 6 pamphlets. Across the 4th pamphlet was written the words, "We will not be silent." They had these pamphlets dropped everywhere. In the middle of the night, in a courtyard, in a market, in the middle of a classroom, in a back alley, everywhere they could, people all over Germany. Well, Hans and Sophie were captured by the Nazis, as was their professor. They were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of the media today. We will not be silent. Democracy matters.
Amy Goodman, speaking of movements earlier this month. Thanks for listening. Special thanks for Wilton Vaught, who recorded Goodman's talk on video and made it available to all on the internet. You'll find this and many other videos on Vaught's blog, Essential Dissent. That's essentialdissent.blogspot.com. You'll find our own website nearby at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes is associated with WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Illigitimae non carborundum. Try to speak the truth, and ciao.